91.3 WLRN presents Topical Currents. This hour we delve into the realm of emotionally charged conflict and how one can mitigate or resolve it. Good afternoon, Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman. Acclaimed Harvard University researcher and negotiation expert Dr. Daniel Shapiro says the catalyst for bitter argument is usually an attack on one's identity, and rationality usually fails to solve these clashes. Shapiro is founder and director of the Harvard International Negotiation Program and a professor in both the Harvard Medical and Law Schools. He's written Negotiating the Non-Negotiable: How to Resolve Your Most Emotionally Charged Conflicts. That's next. First, NPR and regional news.
And Governor Rick Scott has declared.
7 minutes past 1 o'clock. It is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper and Bonnie Berman, our Monday edition. So today we talk about emotionally charged conflicts. They're a focus on every level of human interaction, from nations to business to siblings.
What drives people to engage in such struggles? We'll get insights from an expert researcher, author, and educator. He's Dr. Daniel Shapiro, the founder and director of the Harvard International Negotiation Program.
He's an associate professor in psychology at Harvard Medical School and an affiliate faculty member at the Program for Negotiation at Harvard Law School as well.
His latest book gets at the heart of conflict. It's Negotiating the Non-Negotiable: How to Resolve Your Most Emotionally Charged Conflicts.
And Dr. Shapiro joins us now from Cambridge, Massachusetts and Harvard.
Welcome to you.
Thank you. It is great to be here with both of you.
Well, it's great to have you. And as we said in the opening, we're going to be discussing emotionally charged conflicts internationally, on an international level, political level, professional level, personal level, because they have a lot in common. Is that true?
This is absolutely true. They might seem quite different, but there are a lot of underlying similarities, fundamental similarities in how conflict evolves in these situations.
You know, I was thinking with your when researching and reading your book, that our time is so rife with what seems to be growing conflict and divisiveness. And you would think that because of our interconnectedness technologically now, it seems counterintuitive that we'd be less connected than ever.
I completely agree with you. Our world is more interconnected than ever before, as you said, technologically, economically. Personally, you know, we can connect with people on Facebook halfway around the world and they become our best friend in some senses. So why? What's the problem? And my sense is there's this vast sea of interconnection. In a sense, we're all so interconnected that it's very hard to find our place in this world. And so we often, I find, tend to go back to what I call tribes, to smaller groups that make us feel like we're at home, some kin-based group that we feel emotionally invested in.
Elaborate on the unconscious element of conflict that you talk about in the book, unconscious.
Well, you know, I think we often think that conflict, dealing with conflict, is a very rational process. Two colleagues get into a conflict in the office. They just need to rationally sit down, listen to one another, and everything's going to work out fine. And yet the reality is just the opposite much of the time. They sit down and they might, you know, sort of listen to one another, you know. But in reality, what are they thinking? What are they feeling? There's a lot of potential resentment and so on. How do you get at the underlying dimensions to conflict? That's what this book, what my new book is all about, really exactly that. How do you get to these unconscious levels?
Well, I'm sorry, go on.
No, please.
Well, I was going to say that you say it's composed of three elements. So the rational, which often is not operative, the emotional, but you argue that those don't exist without the element of our identity. So can you explain that? You write so much about identity and different kinds of identity and elements of identity.
So part of the work that I do is with working with hostage negotiators, with many other crisis negotiators. Remember many years back working with this gentleman from the New York Police Department, a hostage negotiator. He turned to me one day and he said, Dan, do you know what all your conflicts have in common? And I said, well, what do they have in common? He said, you were there. You know,
and it's your fault. As
well, it's your fault. And I think what he was also trying to say was that our identity is a part of our every single conflict that we get into, that you cannot avoid your identity being implicated in conflicts. What tends to fuel our most charged conflicts is when we feel that someone has, you know, thrust a sword into our identity, in a sense, into our psychological body. All of a sudden, we react with strong emotions, even if someone's just cutting us off on the freeway. You know, why do we get so upset? Well, on some level, that's an assault on our dignity. It's an assault to some element of our identity. So identity is a part of every conflict on some level.
Can you use the example in the book, because it's how of the identity being threatened in the case of the husband and wife, yeah, arguing over whether to buy this new bedspread?
Ah, okay, yes. So what I'm talking about there, what I found through the research, has been a set of emotional forces that tend to pull us toward divisiveness, even with people we love. And one of those forces is what I call vertigo. And this is that experience when you get into a conflict, you become so emotionally consumed in that conflict that you can think of nothing else other than that, you know, that perpetrator of the conflict, that evil person, even if that's your spouse, your kid. So in the book, I give an example about that. There was a professor of mine from many years back, this very eccentric professor, an English professor. And he said one day he was out shopping for a bedspread with his wife in the mall. He said his wife absolutely thought they needed this $500 bedspread. And he, you know, and he's thinking, this is the stupidest financial decision we're ever going to make. And he says, we're there in the mall. We start getting into an argument and more and more and more. He says, we're yelling over one another. And then he says, for all of a sudden, just for a moment, my eyes averted those of my wife. And he says, I saw there was a circle of onlookers watching us, you know, and I had not noticed it. And then he says, I looked down at my watch. 20 minutes had passed. We had been arguing for 20 minutes, he said. I thought it was 5. And he says, we're now late to meet our friends in the mall for lunch. This is vertigo. This is when we get so consumed in a conflict that we build this sort of warped sense of time and space. And it happens just as much in the international spectrum. You know, Israelis and Palestinians certainly are in the midst of their own problem of vertigo, consumed in the conflict to such an extent that you know, things that happened 60 years ago or 600 years ago, whoosh, it's like there's a time collapse. They're in the present. Does so the past... Yeah, sorry.
No, you go ahead. Please, Professor.
I was going to say the past becomes part of the present, and the feared future becomes the inevitable future, at least in our minds.
Does the example you used about the bedspread argument, does that portray somewhat of the destructive conflict that you talk about, where I'm not only right, but I want to prove that you're dreadfully wrong as well?
Oh, yeah. I mean, the moment that two people or two countries, groups get into this place of vertigo, very easily you can move toward that place of division. Me versus you, us versus them. And it's extremely difficult to break out of vertigo.
Is there a scientific or evolutionary reason we become this way? Because it seems so self-destructive. All it does, I mean, maybe they had to have tribes in prehistoric times in order to survive. But why would, can you talk about it from that standpoint?
No, it's a great question. I mean, tribes are not bad things. At the end of the day, my tribe is what I live for. You know, my family, my wife, my 3 little boys. That is the most important thing to me in the world. You know, and I would die for that tribe. That's reality. So tribes have a wonderful element. You know, we have the United States tribe. They're the good tribes. They're the bad, you know, ISIS, bad tribe. You know, they're all different kinds of tribes. When our tribe falls under attack, or when we perceive it to be threatened, that's when we bring out the guns, whether psychological or real guns. So I think, you know, what we're trying to do is to be loyal to our own people, to our own family, to our own identity. And the moment that identity feels threatened, you know, that's, again, that's when the guns come out.
I know I'm correct in saying this, but will you explain this? Because I think it only takes one party. I mean, if they're both not thinking straight, I don't know how it gets resolved. But it only takes one of the parties in this conflict, assuming it's two people or two nations or whatever, to shift gears and change their behavior, correct?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I was recently presenting to a group of very high-level government officials, and I asked this group, how many of you recently have negotiated with somebody who you believe is utterly irrational? You know, and virtually every hand raised. I then asked, how many of you believe that in that conflict situation, you acted irrationally? One hand hesitantly gets raised. You know, so I think we often think the other side is completely irrational. We're not. But to your point, it only takes one to change the dynamic. You know, if you are in a dysfunctional marital situation, if you're in a difficult workplace situation, it only takes one. Not all the time, but more often than not. For example, let me give you a real-life example. I was just in the Middle East. A lot of my work is around the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. And I was working with a group of diplomats, Israeli, Palestinian, Arab, and broader international. We talked about vertigo and a number of other concepts. About 2 weeks later, I get this email from one of the participants who says, you know, I was just in a meeting, a mixed meeting, Israelis and Palestinians. It was an informal, not formal political meeting. We started talking about some of the very sensitive political issues. And she said in this email, I saw that emotional tornado of vertigo, you know, coming right toward me. And she said, I asked that one critical question. Do I really want to go there? You know, do I really want to go there? She decided no. And rather than having a confrontational conversation, they had a much more collaborative conversation. To your point, it only takes one.
You know, when is it that you're giving in? I mean, it's a fine line, I would think. It takes one. So how do you know when, I mean, people talk about compromise and then it becomes compromising your values or your identity. Is it about compromise? Is it about giving in?
I think people often assume that negotiation is, you know, who's going to give in more? And people are scared to death about that. You know, so I think there's a lot of anxiety that goes into negotiating. My sense is very different. I do not see negotiation as weakness. I see negotiation as utter strength. And there's one useful distinction, which is to separate the process of inventing ideas from the process of committing to ideas. So if you and I are trying to figure out how are we going to divide up this piece of land, you know, the worst thing we can do is to start saying, okay, well, I'll take 25, you know, sorry, I'll take 70%, you're going to take 30%. You come back and you say, no, I'm going to take, and we start getting into an argument. Rather than saying, look, let's just be creative for a few minutes. Let's not commit to any decision right now. Let's just try and invent some options that work for both of us. What if I take, 70% of the land, but I give you 70% of the profits that are for farming for the first 5 years? And so we start thinking about creative ideas, and you might say, no, that's not going to work, but how about this? We're inventing options without committing. You separate those two processes. All of a sudden, you lose the fear of conceding. You gain the benefits of creative thinking.
We're speaking with Dr. Daniel Shapiro. He's a world-renowned expert on negotiation and conflict resolution and founder and director of the Harvard International Negotiation Program. His latest book is Negotiating the Non-Negotiable, How to Resolve Your Most Emotionally Charged Conflicts. A short break, and we'll be back.
And we're back. It is today's topical currents. Joseph Cooper and Bonnie Berman. We're talking about emotionally charged conflicts, among other things, with Dr. Daniel Shapiro of Harvard University. He's also the author of Negotiating the Non-Negotiable, How to Resolve Your Most Emotionally Charged Conflicts. Doctor, tell us a little more about you separate rational and emotional people. Don't we all have an element of both?
Oh, we absolutely, Yes. I think about my mother and my father. And my mother is the utter, you know, she's not trained as a therapist, but she should have been. You know, she's the perfect therapist. Utterly emotional, very comfortable in that world. My father, on the other hand, he's the rationalist. You know, he feels very comfortable when we talk about linear, logical subjects, business, money, this, that. But how you feeling, Dad? Oh, you know. So I think when it comes to negotiating, even to dealing with conflict, it's useful to try and evaluate, what kind of person am I dealing with? Am I dealing with someone who's more comfortable talking about the rational side of things or more about the emotional? Because if you go too far with, you know, either person in the wrong direction, you lose that sense of connection, which is so essential to working collaboratively to work out difficult problems.
If you'd like to join in the conversation, how do you resolve your most emotionally charged conflicts, or don't you? Do you usually find the other person too combative or too adversarial to deal with? Or perhaps you consider yourself a good negotiator? 1-800-743-9576. 1-800-743-9576. radio@wlrn.org is our email.
So, Doctor, why does rationality fail? It seems so rational that it wouldn't.
You know, in a way, I don't think rationality fails. I think emotions themselves are utterly logical. You know, if I say something that offends you, Joseph, or you, Bonnie, all of a sudden you might start to, well, I don't know, what would you feel? You'd probably feel angry or something like that, frustrated, resentful. There's a logic to those emotions. They're giving you a lot of useful information. Well, wait, you know, the idea behind the emotion is, wait a minute, this jerk that I'm interviewing right now just said something offensive to me, and I need to try and understand what it was and defend my own perspective. So I think emotions are actually quite logical. The goal is to try and understand what that logic is. And in the book, I go even a step further and say there are all of these emotional dynamics that sweep us often to sabotage our relationships when it doesn't even make sense. You know, so why, for example, again, back to the colleagues at work, why do colleagues who should be working cooperatively start to play those different games with one another, moving in a destructive direction? There are all of these emotional forces there. Vertigo, we've talked about that. To give you one other example, the repetition compulsion. We've all had reenacted dysfunctional behaviors in our own lives. And the repetition compulsion is about that. I mean, if you think about your own life and the conflicts that you face in your own life, how often with your spouse, with somebody at work, with your kid, do you end up repeating the same dysfunctional patterns of conflict again and again and again and again? That's getting toward that unconscious challenge of conflict. And the book really talks about how you deal with these kinds of situations.
You know, your methods and ideas, and there's so many in the book, and there's so much information in the book, but it seems like they all require the utmost self-awareness. But not everybody is so self-aware. How do you motivate people to want to become self-aware?
Well, I think that's true. Awareness is essential. And, I mean, even Mother Teresa, you know, recognized she needed to become aware. She could always make herself a better person. So in other words, we all are constantly learning. We all can become more aware. It's true. My book, it's not a quick fix. You know, if the listener is looking for, my marital relationship is utterly damaged. What's the one secret to solving my marriage? That's not this book. You know, this book is saying if you want to really deal with the depths of your relationships, to truly get a better relationship at work, at home, in the international realm, what's going on? And so the book gives names to a lot of the dynamics that we experience. Once you have a name for something, you can then say, you know, wait, honey, we're about to get back in vertigo, into that crazy little emotional tornado of conflict. Do we really want to go there? So I do agree with you. It takes a certain degree of awareness. That's what this book is all about, really. You know, it walks you through how to become more aware of dynamics that you might not even know are affecting your relationship, but that absolutely are.
And especially this repetition compulsion. I mean, given by its very name, it's compulsive behavior.
No, that's right. Well, and it's a strange thing, because what the repetition compulsion is about is we tend to repeat the same dysfunctional patterns of behavior again and again and again and again, And if we try to change our behavior, it feels unnatural. Mm-hmm. It feels uncomfortable. Let me give you an example. I have a very good friend who, for some 25 years, lived within an emotionally abusive relationship. I mean, severely emotionally abusive. She was humiliated, degraded on a daily basis. Finally, just a couple months back now, one day out of the blue, packs up her bags in the middle of the day, walks out, drives down to Washington, D.C., and lives with family. She recognized she was in the midst of the repetition compulsion. So she, in other words, she was aware. But what did she do next? And what do you think she did every single day that she was there in Washington, D.C.? Any guesses?
Called him. Called him.
Amen. Every single day. Called him. And more than that, she drove her entire family, all of her friends, all of us, utterly, nearly insane. Should I go back to him? Should I not? Everybody saying, don't do it. Don't do it. Don't do it. But I still love him. But I need him. He needs me. He needs me. This is the repetition compulsion. It is, as one of my colleagues, now deceased, put it, you're like a moth drawn to that fatal flame.
Well, how do you
cannot resist.
How do you break that flight to the flame?
Well, it's exactly on your own awareness once again. You know, and so in the book, I really break it down. And one of the key elements is to become aware of what I call your cycle of discord. What's the typical cycle of conflict that you get into? So, you know, for the marital couple arguing, you know, even over simple things, where to go for dinner tonight. One says Chinese, the other says Indian, and all of a sudden they start, you know, maybe confronting one another, or it's dead silence. They avoid the topic. What's your typical cycle of conflict, of discord? And then you can ask yourself one simple question. What's one behavior you can change? So if the spouse typically confronts the other spouse and the other confronts back, you might make a decision tonight in your next conflict. You know what? I'm just going to try and appreciate my partner's perspective tonight rather than to confront back. Even if every emotional muscle in my body wants to emotionally punch back, I'm going to take a deep breath. I'm going to try and avoid moving toward that fatal flame and say, honey, help me understand, you know, why do you want to go for Indian? And I'm going to try and listen. That's hard to do, but it's possible. And over time, you can break this pattern.
That was going to be my next question, the importance of listening, because, but not only hearing what the other person is saying, but just as importantly, really what they're not saying or what they really mean on an emotional level, right?
Absolutely. The most powerful tool I know for dealing with conflict is appreciation. Now, some of your listeners might go, appreciate. I'm a hardcore business person. Appreciation? Yes, appreciation. Appreciation is when you feel recognized and truly understood for your perspective. And there are three elements that go into it. And I'd recommend anybody just try this tonight. To appreciate somebody else, first, I want to understand where you are coming from. So my wife and I get into an argument. Step one, let me try and understand where she's coming from, but people stop here. And they think, you know what, I understand everything, honey, about what you're saying, but I think you're totally nuts. You know, I think you're crazy. Step two, to appreciate somebody, is to find merit in their perspective, to find value. You know, so help me understand, why do you want to go for Indian tonight, not for Chinese? What's behind it? And the third step, in some culturally appropriate way, you want to let the other side know. To communicate, I hear what you're saying. You know what? That makes sense. I don't necessarily agree with you, but I hear what you're saying, and that makes sense. And the moment you say that, all of a sudden, the other side's defenses fall down. They are more likely to appreciate you now. It only takes one, but this is the power of appreciation. Working again with hostage negotiators, with international diplomats, this is the most powerful tool I've seen in getting cooperation in a very emotionally charged situation.
What if the divide is very so difficult to broach, in the sense, just for an example off the top of my head, the wife who is always complaining because the husband is gambling on NFL Sundays and losing money and is irrationally continues to do so.
Yeah. So, I mean, so there might be things like an addiction in this situation. It may be that in certain situations, professional help is necessary.
I see.
You know, that you know, certainly would be something to consider. In the book, what I talk about is another one of these emotional forces that really connects to your question. Taboos.
Right.
Taboos are social prohibitions. Or to put this in normal language, my mother-in-law put it best. She said, taboos, they're the big no-nos. You know, they're the things you're not supposed to talk about. Or in some relationships, the things you're not supposed to feel. You know, don't express your love to dad. He doesn't express it back. It's taboo. There are the things you're not supposed to do. Don't hug. Don't talk about how mom always loved you more than me. Don't talk about dad's addiction to sports
betting.
Sports betting and so on. And yet you're watching, you know, him bet his entire life away, the whole family's vibrancy away. Taboos are a big deal. And so in negotiating the non-negotiable, I talk about how you can deal with taboos. And there's a simple framework I propose. I call it ACT. A-C-T. How do you deal with, you know, so dad's there. Every Sunday he's gambling with these NBA finals that are going on now. He bet on the wrong team. You just lost your boat. You're about to lose your house. But nobody's talking about it. What do you do? A. The A in ACT stands for accept. Do you just accept that fact that, you know what, he's going to bet away all of the family's, savings and so on. There's nothing you can do. Dad's too forceful of a guy. That's accepting. C. The C stands for chisel it away. Well, you know what? Maybe I won't talk to dad, but I'm going to talk to dad's best friend who really has who dad has an ear to listen to.
Oh.
And I'm going to say to dad's best friend, you know what? Do you think you could talk to my dad for a few minutes? I'm scared to death that he's killing our whole family right now. And the T stands for tearing that taboo down. And this is, you know, the whole family coming together and surprising dad as he gets home after betting away, you know, half the finances and the whole family saying, dad, we need you to change. We need you to want to change.
And
how do you deal with taboos?
And he says, I agree with you, unless it's a sure thing.
Unless it's a sure thing. No, I mean, it takes two to tango. You know, it does say, on some level, it does take two to tango. My recommendation, how do people conceive of conflict? And in the book, but the biggest message I have, in a way, is that people typically think of conflict as something divisive. It is us, the family, against dad. You know, if it's the couples fighting, it's husband against wife, wife against husband, parents against teenager, Israelis against Palestinians. And to me, that's the wrong way of thinking about conflict. Why? Because it doesn't need to be that way. I mean, the moment that it becomes that tribal phenomenon, you're going to get nowhere. It is a battle. I'm sorry to interrupt you, but just to get the big concept, the big challenge is how do you shift it so it's no longer me versus you, but it's the two of us facing the same shared problem. Dad, you know what? You know, you're not the problem. We're not the problem. The problem is how are we going to help our family thrive, survive and thrive, given your habit, given our interests? What are we going to do? Now it's not us versus dad, but it's all of us on the same side of the table facing this very serious challenge.
The relentless we.
The relentless we, exactly. Exactly.
But I'm thinking, and we do have some calls. Again, our number 1-800-743-9576, email radio at WLRN.org, and we're going to get to your calls. But I just want to look at the political landscape for a moment, okay?
Sure.
All right. So it appears that the tribes effect is not only in effect and is dividing us and polarizing us, but actually is responsible for certain candidates' popularity.
Yes.
It's effective in getting votes. So why? So despite its destructive effect on uniting the country, it's actually very effective getting votes. So
yes.
Yeah, so if you would just address that, because it's so operative right now.
Yeah, no, I mean, that is the golden question of our moment in time right now with the elections. You have parties on, I mean, the candidates arguably on each side, who to some greater or lesser extent are very good at creating that tribal phenomenon. We are going to win this, you know, election. We. The question is, how do you define the we? And then I think that's to your point. Is it the we against the others? Or the we as all of us, as some United States of America? I think one can potentially get very close, if not win an election, by building on that tribal phenomenon. We as a tribe against that other tribe. That's not the problem to me. I think the problem is really what happens the moment after somebody wins the election. You know, that next day and these next couple of years, do you now have deeply entrenched divisions within our supposedly United States of America? That's the challenge. You know, I was just in Washington, D.C. recently doing a book launching with Congress. and boy, you see a lot, obviously, a lot of tribalism there. It's right. Us, you know, within sides as well as between sides. Is that healthy? Yeah, it might get you elected again. But is that actually helping the population of the United States to get policies enacted? Absolutely not on so many levels. So you know, I actually would propose that within the United States government, there, you know, we organize some committees now, not just on how to get partisan issues met, but how do we get bipartisan communication and cooperation so that we can actually get things done?
I hope your book did well there.
It was a very well-received reception. It's not a quick fix, though. You know, and I do think that the challenge is, will people and how can people embrace these concepts to really change the fabric of how we deal with these emotionally charged issues that we deeply care about?
Well, let's take a call or two. Our number 1-800-743-9576. First up, it's George, Fort Lauderdale. Go ahead, George.
Hello. Enjoying the show. I wanted to make a comment, inquiry about to the professor about irrationality, where he mentioned where people in the room, you know, were asked if they had dealt with a person that was totally, utterly irrational, and everybody raised their hand. Well, I think that there's an unspoken principle going on, as an illustration, when I was in junior high, I had a friend, and he was short of stature, and he told me that, you know, if you act crazy, if you're a crazy guy, nobody's going to mess with you, or you can win the fight, whether it be physical or verbal. And I think that's what people know, that to be irrational, or the promise of being irrational, is going to win them points in the game. And so this, and it all comes down to that people don't want to appear weak, and once you appear weak, then you have a greater risk of losing whatever it is.
Yeah, no, I hear what you're saying. I do think there can be tactical use to acting crazy.
You have to pick your spots, though.
But there's a huge danger to it as well. You know, I mean, both Democrats and Republicans, to some greater or lesser extent, each have used this tactic, and look at the results. What ends up happening, I mean, take for example, two colleagues in an office. They're in the midst of a conflict. The one decides, I'm going to act crazy. The other decides, well, I'm going to act a little crazier. Well, that's not going to help the workplace very much. How much information is being passed back and forth from one to the other? How much loyalty is there? How good is the decision making? How about the morale every day you go to work? My sense is, you know, one can act crazy perhaps in a single iteration, a single, negotiation interaction. But boy, that's not the strategy I would recommend for anybody who has a long-term relationship. You know, in a marriage, if I say, you know, every time I suddenly act utterly crazy with my wife, it's not going to help our relationship. It may get me to, you know, us to go to the Indian restaurant, but I can promise you she's not going to be a very pleasant comrade, you know, as we sit there. And in the international realm, it's just as true. Israelis and Palestinians, I don't want to judge, you know, in terms of craziness, their behavior. But if either side acts irrationally, does that help or hinder the possibilities of cooperative negotiation? I would argue it strongly hinders that possibility. So again, it can be a tactic of manipulation, tactic of influence, But if you're trying to move toward cooperation, which is most situations in a conflict, I'm not sure it's the best tactic. I want to work with the other. How do you get to work most effectively so we can share information, join together, collaborate, get the best outcome we can that's stable?
Professor, you talk about international terrorism. You say it's also driven at its heart by the tribes effect, which is understandable. But do you think an organization such as ISIS could be dealt with more successfully? And should they even try negotiation with something like ISIS?
Well, I mean, it depends what one's purpose is. I think it's very easy to stereotype an entire group as crazy. Now, I certainly believe that ISIS is reprehensible. What they have done is utterly awful, and it makes me cringe, you know, and truly. Now, if we're trying, as if the United States, for example, is trying to influence ISIS, not necessarily through a bombing campaign, but through other mechanisms, how do you do so? You know, and there are a few ways. You know, ISIS has certainly demonstrated that they're open to some form of communication. They're with their internet campaigns, with all of their internet communications, with the awful videos they're doing. That's part of a back and forth form of communication. They're listening. They're reading the U.S. newspapers as much as we're, seeing the unfortunate consequences of their behavior. Secondly, in addition to that media form of communication, my advice would be for some within the U.S. or Western communities to find some way to interact with, you know, not top-level diplomats or even perhaps even official people, but some people in the West to interact with some in ISIS informally, not and behind the scenes so as not to legitimize anything about ISIS, but to just talk and better understand where are they coming from. Because, you know, it's so easy to stereotype. The more information we have about where their minds are at, the more effectively we can influence them, whether that is through, you know, pure power mechanisms, military, or through more political means. So my sense is, on some level, it could be useful to open up dialogue. What are their interests? Is it truly in creating a sacred caliphate? Well, yeah, maybe. But, you know, is that the only reason these 14-year-olds are joining this organization? I'm not sure. You know, it might be, well, I want to feel the status. My gosh, I saw my 15-year-old best friend on the cover of the New York Times. Mm. I want to be on the Times, too. You know, so there are these other issues that are very psychological that I think are there as well. The more we understand them, the more we can potentially influence the behavior of ISIS toward, you know, more, positive outcomes.
We're speaking with Dr. Daniel Shapiro. He's a world-renowned expert on negotiation, conflict resolution, founder of the Harvard International Negotiation Program, and he's written his latest book, Negotiating the Non-Negotiable. We'll be right back after this break.
And we're back. It is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, and Harvard professor Dr. Daniel Shapiro. We're talking about his book, Negotiating the Non-Negotiable, How to Resolve Your Most Emotionally Charged Conflicts. Our telephone number, 1-800-743-9576. Also, you can email us at radio@wlrn.org, and Bonnie has one of those.
Yes, Josh writes, how can I best deal with a coworker who gave some good advice, though in a humiliating way, shouting, cursing, and intentionally letting coworkers hear? We've not spoken to one another since. Also, cursing seems to be part of the culture inside this profession. Oh, well.
Huh. That's an interest. So you got good advice, but in a very difficult way with coworkers around you. There are a lot of elements at play there. The first question I'd want to know, you said the person's name was Josh?
Yes.
Is that right?
Yes.
Yeah, so I mean, the first question I want to know, Josh, is what's your purpose in this relationship with your coworker? You know, and that's, I think, the most useful first question to ask. Do you want to build a better relationship with this coworker? Is this somebody you've just had enough with? You want to distance yourself from that person? I think the approach to dealing with your problem would start with that point. What's your end goal? You know, and then the question is, how do you get there? one possible, I mean, it's, so there is this very sensitive issue within conflict situations called status. Status is your standing in relation to other people. And I write about it a little bit in the book, but nobody wants to feel put down or demeaned. And it's so easy to do so. You know, even when on the air right now with Joseph and Bonnie, if we're talking and I say, you know, boy, that was a good question. All of a sudden you might feel your status is put down versus that was a good question. Same words.
Right.
Very different meaning. And what I hear you saying, Josh, is I was there on a content level. I got some good advice. But in terms of status, I felt way demeaned. And the question then is, how do you deal with that? If you want to rectify that, one possibility might be to try to find a time to meet with this individual outside of the, you know, the eyes of your colleagues and to say, you know what, I really appreciate your advice. I'm not sure I appreciated fully the way you said it. Did you notice there were other workers around us? I felt a little bit upset by that, you know, but I want to thank you for the advice, but I also wanted to give you this feedback as well.
You're so right, though, because it depends on what he wants, whether he wants a relationship with him to begin with or her.
Exactly. The other possibility, if he doesn't, Josh, if you don't, it might be to say, you know what? Who cares? And just to let that issue of status, it just float on up into the clouds and say, I don't care about that. I'm still, you know, a strong, good person with strong values. People respect me at work. I'm not going to argue back. I'm not going to curse back. I know who I am, and everybody around me can see who I am.
It also might depend on the status of the individual who gave the nasty advice.
Well, the good advice, but in the nasty way.
Right, but their status in the tribe, too.
No, that's true. Right. That is true. Yeah, no, I think that's true. Yes.
And next up, Fernanda in Delray Beach. Hi there. Fernanda, go ahead. Fernanda once, twice.
Okay.
And we go to next caller.
You know, but just one thought there.
Yeah, go ahead.
Silence is a wonderful tool in conflict. It really, I think people often feel I need to, it's like me, you know, you need to fill the space, but not always. I think it's sometimes it is useful to have that moment of silence for listening.
Yes, of course. Greg in Coral Gables, are you there?
Yes, Dr. Shapiro, this is a great call. And I want to just share an anecdote that you might want to continue to talk about because, you know, when it comes to emotionally charged topics, one of the most important ones of our time, as you well know, is that of climate change, and especially down mm-hmm. here in South Florida, which is mm-hmm. considered ground zero for the economic impacts of sea level rise. I don't know if you know, but we have the greatest mm-hmm. value of assets at risk in the world. Mm. By utilizing the very same tactics you've been talking about and that are in this book, a volunteer organization that I'm a member of, but I have about 30,000 friends in this organization. We're about 330 chapters around the world. Citizens mm-hmm. Climate Lobby engages lawmakers in Congress mm-hmm. and local leaders as well mm-hmm. to seek bipartisan solutions on mm-hmm. climate. And so what we've done is by utilizing the very same tactics that you state in this book, and that is listening, showing appreciation, even if we don't necessarily agree on every view, we've brought Republicans to the table on climate. And one of the fruits of this, I don't know if you've heard about this, is and you remind me of it when you mentioned bipartisan solutions. What has come out of this is a recently formed bipartisan Climate Solutions Caucus, and this involves local Republican representatives. Our very own Ileana Ross-Leitanen is on this caucus. David Jolly from Tampa, and the founder of it, the Republican founder, is South Florida's Carlos Curbelo. He is the Republican founder, the Democratic founder of South Florida's Ted Deutsch from West Palm Beach.
Dr. Shapiro, could you put this in perspective of your book?
Absolutely. Oh, I think first, that's fabulous to hear these efforts toward bipartisan cooperation. In the book, very briefly, my first chapter opens with this startling exercise that I've developed over time. I was doing at Davos, Switzerland, there was a meeting of the World Economic Forum, 45 global leaders in a single room. I divided them up into six small groups, asked them for 50 minutes to create their own tribal identity. Who are you? Dress up like your tribe, and so on. 50 minutes later, we come back, and then here's where things get strange. As they're all back in the room, six different groups, the lights go black. Into the room bursts this intergalactic alien, you know, someone dressed up in a costume like an alien who says, I'm going to destroy the world. Unless you can choose one of these six tribes to be the tribe of everybody, and you're going to have three rounds to negotiate it. Round one, no agreement. Round two, no agreement. Round three, time was ticking. This one, six people in the middle of the room, five men, one woman. These men start screaming over another, screaming over the woman who gets so enraged. She yells, this is just another example of male competitive behavior. And boom, soon enough, the world explodes. Davos with world leaders. This is the tribe's effect. How easy it is to put people into a divisive mindset, my identity versus yours. What you're doing, I think, is beautiful in the sense that it's breaking people out of that divisive mindset, moving people toward the recognition, no, we are on this planet together. We're on this spaceship together. This is a fragile spaceship. How can we most effectively preserve it?
Dr. Shapiro, I read that as a boy, you practiced magic. Did you get any insight into conflict resolution when you were Magic Dan, the performer?
That is a great question. in terms of teaching, yes, I've learned a lot. You know, open with a bang, you know, and close with something memorable, hopefully. But you know, I think in terms of magic, things aren't always as they seem. It's back to something I think you said earlier. There's often a subtext to each side's reality. And I think that's really stuck with me. Whereas in a conflict, it's so easy for people to go, they're crazy. To me, the magician suddenly goes, well, wait a minute, what's behind that? You know, what's behind that? What's underneath it? What kinds of questions can we ask to try and discover, you know, why this isn't actually an illusion, but it's, you know, what's the reality behind it?
So was conflict a difficult area for you personally because you're so involved in conflict resolution and sometimes those areas that are difficult for us are the ones we pursue?
It's a great question. I fortunately grew up with a fairly stable family. My parents are still together and so on. I think, you know, I was one of those marginal characters in school, friendly with everybody, but not necessarily at the center of any of the cliques. I think in that sense, a mediator, able to go between different groups, but not necessarily ever at the, you know, at the center of any. My sister was the popular one. She was at the center. But I think that mentality has stuck over time. Nonetheless, every day for me is a learning experience. You know, of course, I get into conflicts with my wife, with my kids. That's only natural that one gets into conflict. For me, they're wonderful laboratories for learning.
In this negotiation, though, can you try too hard to be a people pleaser?
Oh absolutely. I think the goal is not to necessarily be a people pleaser. I think the goal is to get your interests met as best as you possibly can while preserving the relationship or even enhancing the relationship. I was going to say, you know, some people say they pit the hard negotiator against the soft negotiator. Who's better, the hard, tough, crazy person or the soft person? And the conclusion that our organization has come to, you know what, they're both useful. You want to be tough on the problem. I don't want to give in to anything that does not meet my interests well and yours well enough. And yet at the same time, I want that good relationship, that affiliation, so that we can work together to deal with our differences. And I can go home at the end of the day and feel happy when I look in the mirror.
And deal with your three best teachers, you say, are your three children.
Amen. Yes, yes. Those little boys. Yes.
George writes, mentioned the hostage negotiations. Could you please discuss some of the strategies of resolving a hostage situation? And we just have about a minute left, where morally you might oppose buying freedom for the victim, but logistically it's dubious if there's not another option.
Yeah. I think there, again, it goes back to your purpose. You know, if that person is holding somebody else hostage, you want to save human lives there. And I think there's a basic principle. Let's try and save human lives. How do you do it? Appreciation. I want to listen to the extent that that other side truly feels heard in this situation. We have a connection between us. It's the only thing in the world that is going to hold us together to negotiate is that human connection. Once that's lost, you know, unfortunately, it moves to the SWAT team.
Right. Well, wish we had more time. We've been speaking with Dr. Daniel Shapiro. He's a world-renowned expert on negotiation and conflict resolution. He founded and directs the Harvard International Negotiation Program. He's also an associate professor in psychology at Harvard Medical School, McLean Hospital, and affiliated faculty at Harvard Law School's Program on Negotiation. He's launched successful conflict resolution initiatives in several places, including the Middle East, Europe, and East Asia. Negotiating the Non-Negotiable, How to Resolve Your Most Emotionally Charged Conflicts is his latest book. Thank you so much, Professor, for being with us.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. It's an honor and a pleasure to talk with both of you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And that wraps up today's edition. It was produced by Richard Ives. Technical direction from Michael Stock. Polly Landis is associate producer. Also, apologies to those callers we couldn't get to this afternoon. And don't forget about our free audio archives of each Topical Currents program. They're downloadable at our website, WLRN.org, and more information and links and photos at the Topical Currents Facebook page. Paul Leary will be back tomorrow. And tomorrow we look into the vagaries of medical procedure prices. We'll learn more about from WLRN's Price Check website, which keeps track of medical sites and the costs of many common procedures. WLRN Miami Herald reporter Sammy Mack joins us then. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, thanks for listening. Here and Now is next from NPR News.